Thank you for listening to The Zesty Garden. In our next segment, it's called Going Native. And I wanted to make sure that we highlighted more native and drought-tolerant plants in the state of Utah. And we're going to kick this segment off by talking with Jeanette Warner, who's owner of Wildland Nursery in Joseph, and that's just south of Richfield. And Jeanette, thank you for coming all the way up to Logan and talking about natives.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
Well, first off, what floats your boat about native plants, native and drought-tolerant plants?
I think there's several reasons. The main reason to me is they're different. They aren't what everybody else have in their yard.
That's exactly the kind of stuff that I like in my yard. If I see someone else with it, I'm like, I don't necessarily want that.
Right. And just like the copycat of all the houses looking the same, all the yards look the same. And they look the same across the United States, basically. And it's understandable. The pioneers came west. They brought their English heritage, and they wanted that English garden look. And it's not the Western look, and I like the Western look.
And that English garden look in this time of drought and so forth, just it doesn't work so well because those English gardens just want to soak up the water.
Yeah, that's right. And then the other reasons, you know, I have three reasons why I will pick a plant. And, of course, it has to be appealing. It has to look nice. But it also has to have year-round interest. It has to look good most of the year. And the second reason is I like to think that it's a beneficial somehow. It's not only pretty, but it provides food and cover for wildlife. And by wildlife, I don't necessarily mean the deer, the bear, the elk. I mean the pollinators, the butterflies and the bees, and the songbirds, the migrating songbirds.
So Western garden look, year-round interest, and beneficial.
Beneficial, yes.
Okay. One of the things that I want to make sure that our audience understands is that when you talk about native and drought-tolerant plants, for many it triggers an Arizona-type landscape where it's lots of rocks and cactus, and nothing could be further from the truth.
That's right. And sadly to me, there's a lot of that look coming into our state. And they think that that's native. And, you know, okay, it is native and it is drought tolerant, but it is also desert. And there's so many plants here that are very drought tolerant and are beautiful, but they don't look like Arizona. They're not cactus. There's a native plant garden besides cactus and yucca.
And cactus, I love cactus, but I think that should only be one part of the landscape, not the whole landscape.
Not the whole landscape, exactly right.
So let's start talking about some of these plants. So each segment of Going Native will talk about one particular variety of plant that you can grow in your own garden and have great success with. They're should be readily available. You can find them at local growers, or if you can't find them there, going on the internet. But you should be able to find them. And the first one that we're going to talk about is the Alpine Penstemon. So why is this not necessarily number one, but the first one that we're going to talk about today?
I like it extremely well because it is so early in the spring when, you know, in the spring, March comes, everything is kind of dreary, the snow is gone, and the plants haven't really started to grow yet. This one is growing and flowering. And it does naturally grow at the higher elevations, but here in the valley, it starts to bloom around the middle to the end of March. And the bees, the early honeybees, the native bees, they really swarm to it.
What color are we talking about?
Sky blue, a really pretty bright blue. And the other reason I like it is when it gets through blooming, the leaves form this nice mat. So it makes an excellent ground cover. And it's mostly reasonably drought tolerant. In my yard, if it can't go without watering like once every 2 weeks, I don't consider it drought tolerant. And it's a great plant in a dry shade area. People are looking for plants for dry shade.
Oh.
It's great for that.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up because I've got a tree that covers my house and my garage, and there's this space between the two that is exactly dry shade. And I'm always wondering, what can I put in there?
And that's really good.
And so how tall does it get? You said it was a ground cover, can be a ground cover?
It can be a ground cover. The flowers are anywhere from 6 to 8 inches tall.
Okay.
And it does make a nice, once it's established and is spread out, it makes a really attractive ground cover. You know, kind of resembling, you know what a juga looks like?
Mm-hmm.
It's something like that.
And the color of the leaves?
Bright green.
Okay.
Bright green, very showy.
And what happens in the fall?
I think mostly that I don't get a lot of snow where I am in the wintertime. We don't get snow cover. And so the leaves are, they just stay there and they're green, and they finally, like December or something, they will disappear.
So they stay on quite a while.
They do.
As far as we've talked about water, shade, what kind of soil should it be in? So it's an alpine flower. Will it do okay in a lot of areas of the state have this kind of a clay soil?
Right. I always term it average soil.
Okay.
Because I don't think there's such a thing as well-drained soil in Utah unless you're on a road cut up the canyon or something like that. So if you just kind of lighten the soil, work it up, if you have sandy soil, maybe add some compost. Well-rotted compost is good. But they tolerate the alkaline soil, which is what we have here throughout most of the state.
Well, and your soil, I think, in Joseph is even a little bit more alkaline than what I have up here in Hyde Park. So if it's growing there, it should do well.
Right.
Well, here
and,
as well.
And we call it dry clay. So, you know, clay soil holds the moisture a lot longer than sand. So you have to just be careful not to overwater it.
And so that's why dry shade would work. Anything else that you would like to point out about this flower? Sounds wonderful. This light color blue. And how much sun will it take?
Partial sun. At the higher elevation where it grows in full sun. But at that higher elevation, it's cooler and it gets more moisture. So you take that higher elevation and bring it down where it's warmer, then it does need some shade.
So if you put it in an area that gets a lot of regular watering because of a sprinkling system, would it do okay in a sun location at that point?
Yes, right.
Okay.
And I should point out, too, like most penstemons, it's deer and rabbit resistant, which doesn't mean that they're not going to eat it, but it might be the last thing in the garden that they eat. How's so that?
If you've got a tulip right next to it, they're going to eat the tulip.
That's right, yeah.
So is the alpine penstemon an annual or a perennial? In fact, all of the plants we'll be talking about, I'm assuming, will be perennial.
Yes, all the plants will be are perennial, yes.
Okay. And any special things that we need to do to help it through the winter?
Well, what they've, whoever it is that does this research, they have found that it is better to trim back your perennials in the spring instead of in the fall. When I first started gardening, it was to go out in the fall, trim everything back, and have it really neat and tidy for the winter, right? But now they've decided that it helps the plant go dormant if you leave those stalks on. And another benefit to leaving the seed stalks on, the birds can eat the seeds during the wintertime. The only drawback to that is if you don't want them plants coming up everywhere next spring, which natives do. Some natives reseed readily.
And is this one of those?
No.
Okay. So if you were to, and I'm thinking in general for penstemons, if you deadhead a penstemon back, does it produce more blossoms?
Some of them do. Most of them will do it sporadically, not like their first flush in the spring, but some of them will rebloom a little bit.
Okay.
And the alpine penstemon is a great one for rock gardens. If you have a rock garden, it's a great one for that.
Okay, great. So we've been talking about the alpine penstemon in this segment of Going Native. And Jeanette Warner has been my guest. She's owner of Wildland Nursery just south of Richfield in Joseph. Jeanette, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Now here in our next part of the program, I've got Brent Black. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we'll take your questions or comments. The toll-free number is 1-800 800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, and we'll look for your questions or comments there. Brent, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me back.
Do you know what? There's so much that's going on in my garden right now with brambles, but just, what was it, a week and a half ago, or was it last week? You had some a field day in the Kaysville area.
Right. On the 13th, we had a field day for commercial, primarily focused at commercial fruit and vegetable growers.
So what did you find out from this field day?
Well, this was kind of to showcase some of the research that's been going on. There were topics that were covered on berry crops, on tree fruits, and of course on vegetables that Dan Drost was co-organizing the field day. So we had one of the things that we featured on the berry crops was kind of a second generation variety trial that we've been doing on raspberries. So we had a series of variety trials that we did, summer raspberries, fall raspberries, and then a fairly extensive blackberry trial that kind of wound down over the last 2 years, and when we moved in with a kind of a next generation one. So that was one of the featured stops to look at some of the new varieties that were starting to see how well they're adapted to the Wasatch Front.
Now, in my own garden, I'm always trying to try some new varieties to see how well they do. For me, the number one thing is flavor. You know, if it doesn't taste really good, why do I want to have it? So, like, one of those, then we were discussing this before the program. For some people, they like it. For me, I'm like, oh, that stuff's really bland. But it produces a ton, and that's royalty. And you said that's a cross between a black raspberry and a regular raspberry?
A red raspberry, yes, that's correct. So it has the idea there was that you could get some of the flavor characteristics of the black raspberry, which is very unique, and get some of the growth characteristics of a red raspberry, kind of more manageable. The black raspberries tend to be a little bit unruly in their growth habit. They're
much
more
thorny. Tell me about it.
You're finding that out.
I planted Jewel, which is a black raspberry, and I do like the flavor better than the royalty, and it produced a ton, but does it like to ramble around?
Yeah, you kind of have to treat them a little bit like a semi-erect blackberry and kind of pinch them back and try and keep them in their space, because they can be unruly. And they're a lot more thorny than what we typically think of as a raspberry. The other thing that I think that a benefit of the hybrids is fruit size. The black caps or black raspberries tend to be pretty small.
It was a little small.
Yeah. And you get the hybrid and you get a lot bigger berry, so you can fill your bucket a lot faster.
So is the royalty the only option when it
comes to
the hybrid?
There's another one that's quite popular called Brandywine. We included royalty in our variety trial. It doesn't have the most exciting flavor to eat fresh off the plant. It makes a wonderful jam or preserve. It's really, because it has some of those unique flavors, and it yields very well. The fruit are large, and it's quite cold hardy. We've not seen really any winter injury in the 5 years that we grew it, or 6 years that we had it in the trial.
And that's another huge issue for here in Utah. Most of these varieties are developed on the West Coast, in very much warmer winter climates.
Kind of coastal maritime type climate. And so they don't get the winter test that we get. And another thing that is kind of at our disadvantage is a lot of the prevalent theory on winter survival of berries is that they're a little different than a fruit tree, in that with a fruit tree, it's really just the temperature that affects survival of the shoots and the buds. And with raspberries and blackberries, it can be desiccation or drying out. So winter dry, low humidity winds in the winter are just as damaging as how cold it actually gets. And so we have that in spades in Utah. We've got dry, cold winter air that exacerbates the problem a little bit.
So when you're looking at putting in blackberries or black raspberries, some of these that are a little more marginal, do you put them on the side of a building where they're a little bit protected from these winds?
So that can help some. So if you've got a winter windbreak, that will help. And then also the other part of the protection issue is just a lot of what gets us is the temperature fluctuations. And so if you've got them where they have winter shade, particularly in the afternoon, so that they're not warming up a lot on a sunny day and then having the temperature drop so dramatically as the sun goes down, that will help as well.
Okay, so the fact that I've got the royalty and I've had them for the last 5 years and I've had nary a problem with them, mm-hmm. that just kind of confirms your research in my own garden that I am able to grow royalty.
Yeah, it's very cold tolerant.
And so how does Brandywine taste?
So it tastes better. We've not put it in our trials, and so I don't know how well it'll take the winters or really how well it yields in our climate. We had to kind of limit the selection. We ended up with 25 different varieties.
And there's only how many to choose from?
Yeah, exactly. And about 20 different blackberries. And so we're kind of limited for space. And so we had to kind of pick and choose what we included.
Well, and this past blend from fall into winter was pretty severe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a kind of a mild fall and then it got cold very quickly. So we actually saw a lot of damage in our blackberries this last year. And kind of we were thinking about continuing the trial into this summer. And then we had so much winter injury that we decided to end the trial a little bit early just because it was so widespread. And a lot of that, I think, had to do with it going from fairly mild through October, November until it got very cold very quickly. And plants need time to acclimate. They need cold temperatures to harden off and to prepare themselves for even colder temperatures. And when you get these really dramatic temperature drops, they just don't have time to harden off appropriately.
Now, humans can adjust a little bit better, but I'm still thinking of friends of mine who were in Arizona and they moved up here. Uh-huh. And that first winter, they just about killed them. I'm like, this is actually a pretty good winter. So, and then by the next one, they were okay with it.
They're used to it, right? Yeah.
We have a first question. It's from Kathy, and she says, my grapevine was growing great for 3 years, and last year the leaves turned yellow and grew to about 1.5 inches in diameter. This year is much worse, and we are getting no grapes at all. There are some full-sized leaves at the base of the stem, but as the stem has grown, the leaves haven't. I have the grape planted next to the horse corral, if that makes a difference. We have also had a problem with chlorosis in this part of the yard. I have given this grape iron combined with Epsom salts, but have seen no changes this month. What can I do to get grapes again?
So the question is, what's the form of iron that you've put on? If once they get that far behind, it's really hard for a plant to catch up on iron. And that's exactly what it sounds like. If they've seen chlorosis in that part of their yard, and the last two seasons we've had probably more chlorosis than we've had in the past for whatever reason, it depends on the form of the iron. You can get a really strong boost if you use the iron chelate. If you just use the ironite or one of those iron sulfate formulations, you're not going to see really anything in terms of a response. If you want a rapid response, what we typically do is take an iron chelate solution, put it on as a soil drench, and put it on as a foliar application. Mm. So a soil drench will move that iron to the new growth, the emerging shoots, and a foliar application will treat the existing leaves. You kind of have to do both if you want to affect the whole plant.
Now, would it have instructions on the container about how to do that, mm-hmm. so you don't burn the plant?
Yeah, it's very expensive, so you're not going to buy enough to burn the plant typically. It's not a salt that's going to burn, but usually it'll have instructions, and you mix up a solution, and like I say, both the foliar and the soil drench works very well.
Now, if you just put it on the soil but don't drench it in, it's going to take several weeks for it to get in there.
You want to mix it up as a solution and then pour it so it gets down into the roots right away. And the response is fairly rapid. You'll see an effect within maybe 10 days to 2 weeks. You'll really see that have an effect. And this late in the season, you probably want to do both, but you're not going to solve the problem with one application. You may want to go in, treat everything now, and then again early in the spring next year.
So if that's not the issue, is there anything else that's common?
Other issues that might be causing that, based on the description she has there. Number one if it's in an area where you oftentimes see iron chlorosis, often that is associated with heavier soils. We see more chlorosis in susceptible species where we don't get, where we have a heavy clay soil. And so sometimes associated with that is a poor drainage, particularly in the spring. We'll see iron chlorosis where in cool, wet soils that are slow to dry out in the spring, the roots are waterlogged or whatever and have a hard time getting iron. So there may be a drainage issue there. If it's close to a horse corral where there's a lot of manure, there may be some salt issues as well. Mm. It just depends on how close and if they're getting leaching of salts from the manure into the root zone where the grape is.
So raised beds
are going to help a lot. And if you've got a salt problem, raised beds and then a fairly several heavy irrigations to kind of leach those salts or flush those salts out of that soil profile.
So now she's been putting some Epsom salts on there, which is magnesium. Is that going to exacerbate any issues?
It's not going to do anything for iron chlorosis.
Yeah. Will it help the plant at all? How does the plant use magnesium?
So where we have deficiencies, it can have an effect, but it's not going to do anything. And if that doesn't sound like a magnesium deficiency, which is not really particularly common for our area.
So the magnesium doesn't do anything to help change the pH at all.
It's not enough to have an effect in our soils typically. Now, I don't know what her soil conditions are. I'm just guessing here at some of these things, but probably not enough to have a major effect.
So if you got some sulfur, and I've seen at Weeks Berry Farm when they're, because they grow blueberries there, mm-hmm. the soil is yellow because they add so much sulfur in there. And it's fairly inexpensive. Would it do me any good to take and put a lot of sulfur in my bramble beds?
So again, that depends on your soil. So if you have a really
so mine's heavy clay.
Yeah, and it also depends on whether or not your soil's calcareous. So if you have a calcareous soil, so it has the parent material is limestone. Then whenever you add acid, you dissolve part of the soil particles, and that's the extent of your effect. So if you have limestone-based soil, a calcareous soil, and usually those are characterized by pHs in the mid-8 range, yeah. you can pour a barrel of sulfuric acid onto your soil, and it'll fizz for a few days, and then the pH is the same because all you did with the acid is dissolve soil particles. Now that's in the case of Weeks where they're growing the blueberries, they don't have that high of a pH and they've got more, they don't have a lot of that calcareous characteristic. And so they can acidify, but it's the heavier the clay soil, the harder it is to acidify. So it's a lot easier to do in a sandy soil than it is in a clay soil where there's just a lot more buffering capacity there.
So for where I am on the west side of Hyde Park, down on the lower end, down in almost the valley floor, it's not going to hurt anything, but it's not going to help anything either.
What it will do is what Weeks are doing and some of the other commercial growers do is they have a sulfur burner, which they use to create sulfurous acid, which they then inject into their irrigation system along with nutrients. And what that will do is it keeps the nutrients available a little bit better than if they weren't doing that. So they're treating their water as they irrigate, and that can have a benefit. Even if it's not acidifying the bulk soil, it's making those nutrients that they're putting into they're injecting more available to the plant.
I'm not going to be doing that. I've seen how they do it, and it's like, wow, that's a lot of work.
It is. It is.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. My guest is Brent Black, and he's in for about the next 15 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. And we're talking about fruits, whether it be grapes or strawberries or, in this case, brambles. 1-800-826-1495. You can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post a comment there. 1-800-826-1495 is the toll-free number. So getting back to looking at these trials that you did, let's talk about the different the tasting that went on. Now, each person is going to be a little bit different because I've got Caroline. I think Caroline raspberries are some of the best tasting raspberries I've ever had. My wife agrees and my kids agree. My father agrees. My mother, however, thinks they're the most sour tasting berries she's ever had. I'm like, how can you think that? So that being said, overall general, though, you get enough people voting for one or another.
So that that becomes challenging because one of the we run into several snags when we try and evaluate or quantify flavor preference. So flavor preference, what constitute flavor? There's a number of things. One is the sweetness or the sugar content. The other is the acid, which is the sour part that you detect. And then there's some other aromatic compounds that add kind of the complexity to the flavor. The two overriding things are the sweetness and the tartness, or the sugar and the acid, basically.
So I'm guessing that blackberries have more acid than the raspberries?
Well, it depends. So that's
okay, that, again, that on the varieties?
Brings,
okay.
Well, and ripeness. So that's the other factor that becomes a challenge. When we do these taste tests, ripeness has a big effect on eating quality. And one of the things that I run into as I talk to particularly home gardeners that try their hand at growing blackberries, usually the first complaint I hear is they say, well, I don't like them because they're so sour.
Well, they pick them too early.
Because they pick them too early. Exactly. So
they look ripe. They're black.
Right.
But unless you know to look for when that glossy sheen goes to a dull sheen.
Or just test them to see how easily they separate from the plant. A ripe blackberry will come off pretty easy, and one that doesn't, you'll have to pull off pretty hard. So that, you know, the acid, in the case of blackberries, the development of the sugars and the reduction in the acids comes pretty late. And so the fruit colors up nicely and it looks great, but it's just not ripe yet. And the acid content's still high and it's really sour if you pick it. So that comes into play as well. And some people like really sweet with no acid, and some people like lots of acid with a little bit of sugar, and preferences run the gamut. So we've done a couple of different things to try and test what people like and what they don't like. And sometimes it varies over the course of the season, depending on whether you're picking those first primary berries or later on. But one of the things we've done is to get panels and then have them score different attributes of each fruit. Another thing that's been kind of fun to do, and our county agents in Davis County have been heavily involved in this, is they have a farmer's market there at the Utah Botanical Center on Thursdays, and they'll have they'll take whatever fruit is ripe that week and put it out on unlabeled containers, and then as people come by, they ask them if they want to participate, and they'll hand them 10 pennies.
I'd be coming every week.
and there's a bank behind each sample of fruit, and then they can go along and taste everything, and they can vote with the pennies they're given. And they can place all 10 pennies in one bank, or they can spread them out as they see fit. And so we've done that over the different trials that we've done, and that's been really interesting because sometimes so one week it'll be heavily skewed one way, and another week it'll be skewed another way. But it's been an interesting way for us to kind of at least get some feedback on what people like.
Okay, I've got to ask the question, are there any varieties that overall tend to get more pennies than others?
So it's interesting if you look over the course of the trial. We've had, so in the case of the raspberries, we've had a few Pacific Northwest varieties that have scored very, very well in taste tests. And oftentimes those are the ones that aren't winter hardy. So some years we don't have any fruit to even trial, and other years we do. Same with the blackberries. We've had in years where we've had some of the trailing blackberries, the ones that are common to the Pacific Northwest. Those score very, very well in taste tests when they're available. But, you know, one year out of four, we get fruit, and the rest of the time they freeze back. So things like Marionberry, some of those have done very well in our taste tests when we have them, but they're just too intermittent for. So you're talking earlier, your number one criteria is flavor, but a commercial grower wants to make money, and if there's no fruit, they can't make money. So they're looking at yield as well as consumer acceptance.
So for me, it being able to have them one out of every 4 years, while preferably not acceptable, could be acceptable if I get a whole lot that 1 year
and then I can freeze them.
There's
other things you can do. I mean, we've experimented with different things like high tunnels and row covers and things like that. Some of these trailing blackberries, and this is being done more commercially in other parts of the country, we've struggled to get it to work out in the field, but it could be suitable for home garden, is because the trailing blackberries are so prized because of the size and flavor, and because they're trailing, the vines are quite limber. You can actually lay them down and mulch them over the course of the winter, and then in the spring stand them up and get the fruit. And that's something that a home gardener could do that is a little bit challenging to do on a commercial scale, and we've struggled to see that work particularly well.
Well, we're talking about brambles, and Brent Black is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist. We're going to take a quick break and then come back and finish our discussion. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495, or you can send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. Welcome back to this part of the Zesty Garden. In our gardening calendar, the Friends of the Logan Library features a course today on herbs for nutrition. It's from noon to 1 o'clock. Learn what they are and how to use them by Josh and Amy Choate of Logan. Information is at facebook.com/Logan Library Friends. The Tahnaquit Nature Center in St. George is hosting Fall into Vegetable Gardening. It's Saturday the 23rd from 10 to 11. One of the benefits of living in Southern Utah is the long growing season, and you can learn how to make the climate work for you and your vegetables. All workshops are free and open to the public. The Tahnaquit Nature Center is at 1851 South Dixie Drive. The USU Botanical Center in Kaysville is hosting a seed-saving workshop on September 4th from 4 to 6 p.m. Learn how to save seeds from your favorite vegetables and flowers in this two-hour class. Participants will get to collect seeds to take home. Information is at ogdenbotanicalcenter.org. And then the Escalante Farmers Market takes place Saturdays from 9 to noon through September. The market is at West Main and South Center Street in Escalante. My guest for the rest of the, well, for about 10 more minutes, is Brent Black, USU Extension Fruit Specialist. And Brent, I'm going to ask you now, those pennies can, over a period of time, probably have certain varieties that come to the surface and seem to pull better anyway, P-O-L-L. So tell me, to start with raspberries.
So with the summer raspberries, we have, one of the ones that we included is Tulamine, and you've asked me about Tulamine in the past. It's kind of considered the flavor standard for red raspberry. It's very popular, and it's one of the Pacific Northwest varieties that we found out doesn't do very well here. So it's kind of hit and miss. But interestingly enough, when we did some of the flavor or consumer preference panels, we had a few of the Cascade series that scored quite high with it, Cascade Delight and Cascade Bounty. And they have done quite well. Cascade Delight has done pretty well here. That's kind of become one of our internal standards for our next round of trials, because it's the winter survival wasn't fantastic, but it was certainly better than Canby. And Canby's kind of been the old standard, and it Canby scored quite high in flavor preferences, but it was still in the bottom third in terms of winter survival, and so our yields were a little bit inconsistent with it.
Now, I do have the Cascade Delight, so I'm in a colder zone than where these trials are taking place, and I can say I've not had any issues.
Done well,
yeah, it's done really well.
Good.
I still like the Canby. It's hard to give it up, and I can always tell where my Canbys are. Even though I pulled them all out, all of a sudden after 2 years, I've noticed over by the side of the house, here's some raspberries coming up, and it's doesn't have a lot of thorns on it.
It's smoother.
And I thought, how did that get there? I never planted it, but there it is, and I'm letting it go. So, and then there's a couple in the garden that just popped up. So I'm like, okay, I don't really want these, but I'm going to let them go because I like the taste so well. So that's summer raspberries.
So of the summer raspberries, those have done well. And interestingly enough, of all of the summer raspberries that we had, royalties scored second to last, so you'll notice that.
Why am I not surprised
that they don't disagree with you on the on their preferences. With the I'm looking at the wrong thing. With the fall raspberries, the one that scored consistently highest was Anne, which is the yellow fruited one, and I think you've tried that and you can confirm that.
I really like the flavor. It doesn't seem to be I'm having some issues with cold hardiness, with it being
too late.
Yeah.
It just as it's hitting its stride, it's
all of a sudden it's like, I haven't had these yet.
Right, so. Right. Yeah, and that's a problem. With the fall bears, the ones that we had, it yield the amount of fruit you get is all we now. Let me clarify this. With our fall bears, we only collect a fall crop. We don't try and double crop them. So after the harvest in the winter, we mow them right to the ground. So we only get the primakane crop.
Right after the harvest?
Well, after they've gone dormant, the leaves have dropped. Yeah, we just mow them to the ground before the next season. So,
and that's what I end up doing. Right, I don't do both.
And I should clarify, if you leave them alone, you'll get a floricane crop on those canes, on the lower part of the cane in the summer. So you'll get a summer crop and a fall crop. And we don't do that. We just cut them
back.
They
just seem to do better.
You'll get more in the fall if you don't if you don't try and double crop them. And for those, so Anne did very well. Polka was number two, and that yields pretty well. It's an earlier one. In fact, of all of the fall bears that we had in that first trial, it is the earliest. And so it comes on early. You get pretty good yields year after year after year because it's coming on so early. It'll usually run its course before you get a fall freeze.
And I've got Polka in mind. I've not had any issues as far as cold hardiness or whatever, and it seems to be doing pretty well too.
And so that one was good. Joan Jay is a newer variety that it was quite productive.
Like Joan Jett and the Blackhearts?
Yeah, only the Jay.
Yeah.
And that's done pretty well. It scored in the top third with as far as flavor preference, and it was the highest yielder next to the Polka. So it's a little bit later than Polka. It's similar season to Caroline, and it was the preference was quite good.
See, that's really helpful for when you've got colder areas and you could get a heavy frost by the end of September. You've got to look for something that's going to come on
a
little bit
earlier.
Come
on and go. So we another one that is early like that we have didn't have in the first trial that we're trying now is Palana, which is another fairly early one, and that the people seem to like that berry as well.
So curious, since everyone that I know seems to grow Heritage, where did Heritage show up in these?
So it was as far as yield, it was near the bottom. As far as fruit size, it was near the bottom. But as far as flavor preference, it was up there with Polka and Joan Jay. It was in the top third. But it's just the berries are small and so yields are poor because it's late.
So Caroline, where does Caroline fit in? I haven't heard Caroline. I'm like, what?
So Caroline was in the top third in terms of yield, and it came out dead last in the flavor.
You're kidding me.
I think a lot of our panelists didn't like the higher acid, the sour, more sour
fruit. See, to me, again, it's just personal preference, but my whole family, they have the best raspberry. What I would say, I'm looking for a raspberry flavor.
Yeah.
That it's just phenomenal. Yeah. And I love how productive mine are. And these berries, they're humongous. They're like the size of my thumb.
Size is good. Size is really good on them. One of the issues that
we've great.
Heard...
I'll just keep growing Carolines.
Well, what I was going to ask you, how long have you had your Carolines?
They've been in probably 7 years, 8 years.
So one of the complaints I've heard, and we don't have any data to show this, is that the Carolines kind of run out of steam earlier in the planting. So after 7 or 8 years, the planting...
They just start dying out.
Yeah, they lose their vigor and so forth. And so I'll be curious to see how yours turn out.
Well, I didn't weed too well this year, but the ones on each end that get more water seem to be doing okay.
A lot
the
better.
Ones in the middle, I can't quite tell because I haven't gone through and weeded everything out. But, dang. Well, that's not good to hear. So I'll keep track of that and let you know exactly what happens over the next couple of years.
Okay.
Okay. So looking at black raspberries, were those.
So we didn't do any black raspberry trials. We did blackberry trials. And so really, this was no surprise. The winter survival and yield of blackberries had a lot to do with the type that they were. So there's three different blackberry types that we grow. There's semi-erect, erect, and trailing. And I listed them in order of adaptability to Utah. The semi-erect are the most cold hardy. And so because all but a handful of blackberries are summer bearers, if you don't get survival of the canes, you don't get fruit. And so we saw that the semi-erect types were the highest yielding of all the types. And of those, the best in terms of yield and in terms of winter survival and in terms of flavor preference was Triple Crown.
Interesting.
Chester was a close second in terms of winter survival, but the flavor on it was quite, it was rated fairly low.
So in my colder zone up here where it's kind of iffy even with Chester, I'm going to plant a new variety, so maybe I should try Triple Crown because I'm going to plant them on the east side of my barn rather
so
than
I
the
have,
west side.
I have Triple Crown growing in my backyard, and the fruit, we're just getting the first ripe fruit now. And it showed a lot of, it did not look good after this last winter. The initial leaves that came out were yellow, the vines or the canes were weak, and it's come back and it's producing quite well. So I can recommend that one. I really, that's kind of the one that I think works the best for us.
And you're also here in Cache Valley, so
right.
That's good. And what kind of soil do you have?
Our soil's a little bit heavy, so we have to put iron chelate on. We'll see chlorosis. And we did put some iron chelate on our on the Triple Crowns.
Do you lay the canes
no,
down
I don't.
In the winter?
Okay. So these are the semi-erect types. A lot of times the canes are fairly stiff, so you're going
to
have a hard time getting them to lay down without a lot of extra manipulation to keep them so that you could lay them down. And
we don't
go to that.
So we have
extreme.
60 seconds. What else do you have left?
Well, the trailing types that people really like for flavor, we found a new one that hadn't been named until after the trial was over called Newberry. It's in that classification of the trailing types like Marion, and that's the most cold hardy. It doesn't yield nearly like the Triple Crown do, but if you had a place where you could lay it down, the trailing types have really big fruit. They're early, and the flavor's really nice. It's just you see a lot of winter injury.
So how much winter injury with Newberry?
Well, if they're left out to their own devices and uncovered, you're seeing maybe 50-60% die back in a typical year. But
okay. But
with a little bit of protection in a backyard, you could do a lot better than that.
And a great website to go to, because we didn't even get to talk about some of the native berries like serviceberry and chokecherries. It's fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Just one, fruit.usu.edu.
Correct.
For information on pretty much anything you'd like to know about growing fruits in the state of Utah. Brent, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Brent Black is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we'll have him back in again. Coming up next is Helen Cannon and Petals and Prose.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. I would like to continue considering Emily Dickinson as a gardener. And as I mentioned last time, the people in her township most likely thought of her only as a gardener, not as a poet. Indeed, during her lifetime, Emily Dickinson was known more widely as a gardener, perhaps, than as a poet, says the author Judith Farr. Susan Dickinson's unfulfilled plan for a memoir of her sister-in-law listed love of flowers as Emily's first attribute. Her poetry, for the most part privately published, was often enclosed in letters pinned together by flowers, or in bouquets that made the poem concealed at the flower's center. And the flowers themselves, one message. Her father said of John Ruskin, whose modern painters deeply influenced Emily Dickinson, that he was a geologist first and an artist later. Even before she wrote poems, Dickinson was engaged in gathering, tending, categorizing, and pressing flowers. After writing, poet became her central preoccupation. Cultivating bulbs, plants, and flowers within a portion of her father's land and in a glass enclosure of a conservatory built just for her remained a favorite occupation. Not only did Emily Dickinson, but her mother and sister Lavinia tend gardens of the mansion called the Homestead. Emily speaks with frank possessiveness of my Puritan garden, yet in 1877 she describes Vinnie's garden from the door looks like a pond with sunset on it, and deplores heat, writing, Vinnie rocks her garden and moans. Emily had assisted her mother in the garden since she was 12, first at the house on West Street and then in the mansion on Main Street. During the 1860s and 1870s, her years of greatest artistic productivity, she was also developing skills, growing gardenias, jasmine, sweet peas, camellias, oleander, roses, heliotrope, and many other naturalized and native flowers. Just as her poems were uncommon, some of the flowers she chose to grow are unusual, gorgeous, and complex. Others, like gentians, anemones, were wildflowers associated with her simplicity of mind and heart, with youth and humility, fresh imagination, and the possibility of everlasting life. All were indices of her own spiritual, emotional state, while in her letters and poems she continually associates flowers with herself, making gardens and making poems. So I got out my Emily Dickinson collections and began reading and realized for the first time how many poems refer to flowers or are centered around flowers. Mid-Victorians like to pun on the aesthetic associations between posies and poesies. Her flowers were Emily Dickinson's other poems. That's what she called her flowers, her other poems, which the conservatory could safely enshrine in an age when what Hawthorne contemptuously called women scribblers were not always received in society. Indeed, to be a notable gardener was a much more acceptable avocation for mid-Victorian women, meant to be the angel in the house, than to be a poet. Edward Dickinson, who was prouder of his only son's letters than of his brilliant daughter's poems, may have given Emily a conservatory, not only because he wished to please her, but because growing flowers was to him a more suitable occupation for a woman than writing verse. In her death notice, we can see this emphasis. It reads, "The death of Miss Emily Dickinson, daughter of the late Edward Dickinson at Amherst on Saturday, makes another sad inroad on the village, except among the older inhabitants knew Miss Emily personally, although the facts of her seclusion and her intellectual brilliancy were familiar Amherst traditions. There are many houses among all classes into which treasures of fruit and flowers were constantly sent that will forever miss those evidences of her unselfish consideration. One can speak of duties beautifully done, of her gentle tillage of rare flowers, filling her conservatory, into which, as into the heavenly paradise, entered nothing that could defile, and which was ever abloom in frost or sunshine, so well she knew her chemistries." Although Susan, this is her sister-in-law, writes admiringly of Emily's poems, her swift poetic rapture was like long glistening note of a bird in June woods at high noon. It is her gardening that she attributes technical, virtuosic knowledge. The poems, over 250 of which were sent to Susan to read over the years, are described as tossed in startling picturesqueness on the page, a remark that is itself startling, coming from one who had constant evidence of 4 decades of how ardently Dickinson strove for the right word and the right image. Herself an amateur journalist and an aspiring, if incompetent, verse writer. The Dickinson property during the poet's lifetime was in effect a small farm with a barn, a fruit orchard, a vegetable garden, and a meadow across the road. Because Dickinson's poems and letters almost wholly concern flowers, However, this book does not give space to the pear and apple trees, the asparagus and potatoes that her niece remembers. It focuses on the premise that an understanding of the importance of her flowers in general and specific flowers in particular enriches our understanding of Emily Dickinson's life and art. She herself defined flowers and her poems as related gifts of the muse. Emily never explained how her flower garden was arranged. She kept no lists or records of her successes with various flowers, but she did allude to the flowers, their health and growth, in letters. According to the accounts of others like Martha Dickinson, she naturally designed cottage gardens that were evidence of the growing movement away from Victorian and European formalism. Emily, however, relished fragrant masses of seasonal bloom, but with an underlying plan, as her niece recalled. There were long beds filling the main garden where one walked between a succession of daffodils, crocuses, and hyacinths in spring, though midsummer richness up to the hardy chrysanthemums that smelled of Thanksgiving, savory and chill, when only the marigolds, called them marigolds, were left to rival them in pungency. Many of the flowers were veritable old-time perennials, punctilious in reappearance. Well, there is a lot that could be said about Emily Dickinson and her flowers. I hope that you'll take interest in this and perhaps look up the two books that I've used, this one by Judith Farr and the one by Marta McDowell. So thank you for listening. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.